Exile, May 1906 to September 1909. A demon week later, Father and I moved across the bay to a place in the foothills above Oakland. We used Miss Whitlaw's wagon, taking it across on the ferry. Later, Father would return it to the Tong man in San Francisco who had agreed to buy it. The wagon rattled up a dirt path to a plateau halfway up a hillside. The winds roared so loudly about us that Father had to shout to me.
"Feel those winds, Moonshadow?" Father asked. "Aren't they beautiful? They'll help us when we try to launch the flying machine."
I tried my best to hold onto my hat. "Are they like this in the winter time?"
"I guess so," Father said. "In fact, I hope so. We'll be testing our models every clear day."
I said nothing, because I did not want to spoil Father's enthusiasm. As the wagon rolled on, Father went on making plans. In his own mind, he was already flying. Father took the path that led away from the roadway. Eventually, we came to an old iron fence covered with a tangle of weeds and shrubs. I suppose at one time there had been a gate over the path, but someone had taken it away. Father told me that we were living on what had once been a rich estate belonging to the Esperanza family. At first, we were surrounded by former orchards of apple, cherry, and apricot trees that had now become wild. I found out later that their fruit was too small and bitter and full of worms to be eaten, but right then the trees filled the air with a sweet, promising scent of blossoms. Past the orchards in the middle of the estate was a garden that must have covered nearly 10 acres. It seemed as if the garden held every type of flower, bush, herb, and tree in the demon land, but because no gardener watched them, they now grew helter-skelter in a riot of color and greenery. Finally, Father stopped the wagon before two large ramshackle buildings. I looked at the larger one, which seemed to have once been a mansion constructed in the demon style. "Are we going to live in that?" I asked doubtfully.
"In that old ruin?"
Father laughed and pointed out the places on the sides where some scavengers had already taken the boards away. The panes of glass in the windows had been either broken or stolen, and the roof had begun to cave in. Father nodded at the other building, a large one of plain, straight design. It was about 2 stories high, but there were only a few windows at the level of the first story.
"No, sir. We're living in the barn."
When we first walked into the barn, the smell nearly knocked me down. Father set down his box of ammonia and disinfectants. I had wondered why he had spent so much money on them, but now I knew. The barn was awfully drafty, too, but I guess I ought to be grateful that it was. We scrubbed and soaked and tried almost everything to get rid of the smell of horses and manure. But even after a day's work, we did not quite manage it. Disappointed, Father said,
"Maybe this will help."
He went over the left wall of the barn where the stable hand had once slept in a little walled-off section. There was a pot-bellied stove there, and a pipe leading from it to the wall to let out the smoke. There was already a shelf on part of the wall. Father put Uncle's cup of soil there and slipped a dozen incense sticks into it and lit them. Little plumes of smoke, thick as worms, began to writhe in the air.
"There," he said, stepping back. "If we can't chase out the smell, maybe we can cover it up."
"Yes, sir." I rolled my sleeves back down after washing my arms and hands. Somehow I knew that the incense would never quite get the smell out. I set a board over 2 empty boxes and then rummaged around in our things until I found the paper, ink, and inkwell. Then I got some water from the pump outside.
"What are you doing?" Father asked.
"I'm getting things ready for a letter to Mother. We haven't written her yet, telling her about our change in plans. The last thing she's heard is that we were in the Tong people's town helping the company rebuild the store. I thought if we wrote a letter this afternoon, you could mail it when you went back to return the wagon." Father sat down reluctantly on the dirt floor before the board.
"I can just hear the schoolteacher now, telling everyone in the village."
"It's Mother who has to listen to them laughing," I pointed out.
"I wish I could spare her that."
Father chewed the end of the brush's wooden handle.
"We have the easy part. All we have to do is fly. She has to live in the village."
Saying that, he began to write. Father worked as a handyman or an all-around mechanic when he could, but he would cut firewood or do almost anything so long as it was legal and it paid. I managed to get a job as a delivery boy for a grocer, but it meant I did not talk much with Father. By the time I got home, cooked dinner, and did my lessons and my chores, I would be so tired that I would go right to bed. Eventually, I wound up running our household, or maybe our barnhold is a better word. Among other things, I planned our meals, washed our clothes, kept the barn as clean as I could under the circumstances, and oversaw the budget once Father showed me how to do it. That left Father all his free time to work on flying. Somehow, we managed to send some money home, too. Once a month, on a Sunday, I walked down into Oakland and rode the trolley to the ferry depot, where I would join a lot of other Tong men, houseboys, and other day workers. From there, we would ride the ferry boat over to San Francisco. Father never went, because he did not want to waste any of his free time. Once I was in the Tong people's town, I would deposit our money with the district association and pick up letters. Sometimes there were notes from Handclap or White Deer, who would convey Lefty's regards, since Lefty himself could no longer write. Then I would finish shopping and start the long trip back home, arriving late in the evening, usually to find Father bent over the table, working feverishly at the plans or finishing some model he was going to test. I don't know whether the smell of the barn got less, or our noses grew used to it, but after a while we stopped noticing it. Spring turned into summer, and the grass in the garden changed into a ruddy gold color. When you walked through the orchards, the air was thick with a sickly sweet smell of fruit rotting on the ground. It was not until early August that we received a reply from Mother and Grandmother concerning Father's revelations. It was a thick envelope, so I had expected several pages, mostly from Grandmother, scolding us. But when Father opened it, there was only one single sheet and a second, smaller envelope. He spread the sheet out quickly on the tabletop and began to read out loud. I sat across from him, fiddling with my own writing brush while I listened. As we expected, Grandmother called Father a fool, who was a disgrace to the family, both the living and the dead, and so on. I was surprised that the schoolmaster's brush had not burned up, but she again warned us to watch out for the water in our new demon home, so I suppose she had not totally turned her back on us. As also could be expected, Mother was patient and understanding, saying what a truly wonderful thing it was to meet the Dragon King. Father picked up the second, smaller envelope and slid it over the table to me.
"It's for you," he said, puzzled.
I reached over and turned up the light from the kerosene lamp. Sure enough, my name was on it. It was the first time I had ever had a letter addressed only to me. Father drummed his fingers on the tabletop.
"Well, aren't you going to open it?"
"Yes, of course." I hastily tore open the envelope and slipped out the thin rice paper sheet. I read the letter silently. "It is very hard to say these things by the hand of another. I long to hold you, but the only comfort I can offer are these words which I myself cannot write. But though the words are written by another, they are my words nonetheless. Above everything else, you must not show this letter to your father, for I must tell you some things about him. First of all, I knew he was an unusual man when I married him, but I had no idea he had once been the physician to the Dragon King himself. I do not care what the others say. I am bursting with pride right now. But this brings me to the second thing. I wish more than ever that I could be with you right now, for your father has undertaken no small task. But since I cannot be there, you must love him doubly hard. You must give him not only your own support, but also try to give him mine as well. It is a great deal to ask of you, but I know you will be able to do it. I have not seen you now for 4 difficult, impossible years, and yet from your letters, I feel that you are still the child I love, and that you will soon be a man that I can be proud of." At the bottom of the letter was Mother's name. I read through the letter several times, feeling suddenly very sad and tired. I had not really thought about my mother in a long time.
Well, Father demanded impatiently, what does your mother say? I suppose it must be your mother. Your grandmother would never waste money on a second letter.
I folded the letter and put it carefully back into its envelope. I think she understands, sir, about not telling her your dream and about the delay in bringing her over. Father pointed at the envelope still in my hands.
Does she say it in there?
He looked as if he were eager to read it. No, sir, but that's what she means.
How do you know?
We used to figure out what to put in each of our letters to you. I know what she'd say and what she wouldn't. Father massaged his forehead.
How long has it been since I've seen her? He asked himself. I think almost 12 years. Why do I want to bother with flying anyway?
White Deer says that you can only follow the course of your own nature. I got up and poured a cup of tea for Father and set it down in front of him. I wished Mother were there. She would have known the right things to say. But as it was, I had to try to stumble through in my own clumsy way. And who knows? Maybe one of these days we'll fly back across the sea and pick her up. Father laughed and seemed to relax.
I'm afraid that hand clap's more likely to build that kind of machine than me. I'll be happy if I can just stay in the air for a few minutes.
But you could tell he felt better. He gulped down the tea.
Well, we better be getting back to work.
Then it was fall, and the rains came. The trees of the orchard began to lose their leaves and look like sheep huddling against the fence, and new grass and flowers began to shove their way up through the now old and dried-out growths in the garden. When I could, I would spend a lot of time outside, sitting on an old crate by the side of the barn, watching the fog drift in close through the trees, snagging on the branches or crawling cat-like through the garden. It was about the same temperature whether I was inside or outside the barn. We had done our best to repair the holes in the roof, but there were still one or two little leaks that dribbled all the time. We had no spare money to replace the broken panes of glass in the windows, but we did the next best thing by taping some heavy paper over the holes and oiling the paper so it became translucent. It helped cut the wind down some, but still let in the light. We had also tried to cover up the spaces between the boards with mud and straw, but even so, the wind would get through into the barn. And the place was so huge that we could never quite warm it up. By now, Father had hung huge models of the flying machines, some up to 6 feet in wingspan, from the rafters, and these would twist and turn as if they were giant captive moths. But winter was my favorite time to be outside, on those special days when the rain had stopped and the fog had burned away. The air had been washed clear of any soot or dust or smoke, and the whole world seemed fresh and crystal sharp. I could look out then and see the city of Oakland lying stretched out at the foot of our hill, all the houses looking like toy blocks. And beyond Oakland was the bay, smooth as a pane of green glass. On any sunny day, you would see sailboats gliding over the surface, leaving fine white lines behind them that were the wakes. Their sails would belly out full and white before the wind, and the breeze would rise up from the bay, cool and salty, passing over the hissing grass. And beyond the bay was the city, the only city as far as I was concerned. In the next 3 years, I watched as much of it was restored. The ships would lie at anchor by the wharves like lazy water bugs. You could see the streets tilting skyward and the houses scattered over them like varicolored beads, and the brightest cluster of beads was the Tong people's town. It was as if the earthquake had only been a bad dream. But if the view in the daylight was good, the view by moonlight was even better. Then all the lights in the houses burned. Below our hill, the lights of Oakland would gleam like a cloud of fireflies, and the wrinkling waters of the bay would turn to quicksilver under the moon. And beyond the bay, beyond even the ships with the lights hung on their sides, would be the lights of San Francisco. Thousands and thousands of kerosene or gas lamps glittering like the gold scales of a serpent. It was like a river of light, and each light represented a person, or maybe several people, the lights of their homes or the streetlights outside them. and I did not think of them as scrabbling for money or being stupid or malicious. It was as if they had each become a tiny star shining in the darkness. I had found my mountain of gold after all. And it had not been nuggets, but people who had made it up. People like the company and the Whitlaws. I had not realized until I had left it that I had been on the mountain of gold all that time. And somehow, being on our hillside, I felt above it all now, somehow freer and purer, working toward the fulfillment of Father's dream. Somehow, all the worries and fears of the past seemed small and petty now. Those next 3 years were hard years. I was cold sometimes. I was hungry other times. I was tired most of the time. But I could not say I was really unhappy, only uncomfortable. All about me I had Father's dream taking visible form, first in the pictures and the articles he had taped to the walls, then in the models and diagrams he began to hang up, and finally in the skeleton of the flying machine itself, which he began to construct with light wooden poles. And on 3 Sundays out of the month, there were trips to the Whitlaws. At first I had felt sorry for Miss Whitlaw, but I should have realized there was nothing that could faze that lady. She had her stained glass window carefully wrapped in cloth and brown paper inside a box that Father had built for her, and she always had her stereopticon and slides and some of her books. Some Sundays, though, they would come to visit us and help fly Father's huge model gliders. They were as thrilled at Father's progress as we were. And when we began to actually build the aeroplane, they made a point of coming down with an already fixed cold supper and helping us. But though they called it the aeroplane, or sometimes the flying machine, Father and I always thought of it as Dragon Wings. It took 3 years to build Dragon Wings, because we never seemed to have much money to go around. We were still sending money home to my mother. And because we had to learn by trial and error how to build the frame and stretch the canvas over it. But by the end of the summer of the demon year 1909, we were ready. Father once tried to explain to me just how the aeroplane was supposed to work, but I never did follow much of it, though I do remember the shape. The aeroplane had no solid body. It was only an empty frame about 20 feet long, 4 feet high in front, and angling up and back to only about a foot. The canvas-colored wings, which were 40 feet long and 6.5 feet wide, were on top of the frame's center. 6-foot-long struts separated the top wing from the bottom one. There was no cockpit, as there is in modern flying machines. The pilot lay flat on his stomach on the bottom wing. To his right, also on the wing, was an engine which powered the two propellers by a gear and sprocket system like the one on a bicycle. The propellers faced to the rear, pushing the aeroplane forward rather than pulling it. In front of the flying machine was a pair of smaller wings, about 4 feet long and about a foot apart, which the Wrights called horizontal rudders. Future aeronauts would call these little wings elevators because they forced the aeroplane up and down in the air. The little wings could be tilted upward or downward. When they were aimed upward, they sent the wind at an angle around and through the rest of the aeroplane so the machine would go up. When the front edges were aimed toward the ground, the machine was directed downward. Father handled these with a control held in his right hand. In the rear of the frame was another set of wings, also about 4 feet long and a foot apart, but these rose vertically rather than horizontally. The vertical rudders allowed the aeroplane to make a level turn to the left or to the right. But an aeroplane can also turn in another way once it is in the air, and that way is also called banking. As the Wrights wrote Father, banking had always been a problem for earlier aeronauts who had tried to do that simply by shifting their weight around inside the aeroplane. The Wrights had solved the problem by controlling the shape of the wings. Orville told Father to think of a box from which both ends had been cut and which Father was holding in his hands, his left hand holding the top forward corner and rear lower corner of one end, and his right hand holding the top rear corner and the forward lower corner. If Father moved his left hand downward and moved his right hand upward, the top and bottom of the box would twist or warp. The front left edges of the top and bottom of the box would curl downward, while the front right edges of the top and bottom would curve upward. If this happened to the two wings of the aeroplane, the two sides of the aeroplane's wings would be presented at different angles to the wind. As a result, the left sides of the wings would rise and the right sides would dip, flying faster than the right sides, so that the aeroplane would bank to the right. That is, the aeroplane would seem to pivot on the right sides of its wings and turn to the right. The wings could be warped in the opposite way, of course, so that the aeroplane would bank to the left. Father built controls for the vertical rudders and the warping mechanism of the wing, following the design of the Wrights. Since there was neither seat nor seat belts, Father had to hold onto the flying machine with his left hand. The only way Father could control both the rear rudders and the curving of the wings, by moving his hips left or right inside the wooden cradle, he could make the machine turn either left or right. But of course, he could not make a level turn to the left or right that was separate from banking to the left or the right, as you can in a modern flying machine. Father's own improvement on the Wright's original design was to put four wheels on the bottom of the frame center. If the flying machine and the control system sound funny, you have to keep in mind that these machines were among the first ever built. It was hard to believe when you saw a picture of the Wright's flying machine that it really could fly. It was mostly a skeleton of wooden poles, with canvas stretched only over the wings. It seemed like a rather flimsy thing to trust your life to, as it was not much better than a big kite. Our motor was only about 12 horsepower, which we thought very powerful, for in 1903 the Wrights had hunted both in this land and in the other demon lands over the seas for a lightweight engine producing some 12 horsepower, and they had been unable to find one. They had to build their own. Fortunately, engines of the kind we needed were now available, but they were expensive. We had to dip heavily into our savings. And of course, the propellers had to be carved exactly according to the Wright's tables. That was a headache, believe me. Somehow, we did it. Neither the costs nor the troubles we met building dragon wings could stop us. Finally, there came the day near the end of August when Father announced that we were ready. It was a good thing we finished it when we did, because we were just about broke. We had tried to pay our rent, food, expenses, and money for Mother out of our earnings, but little by little we had to dip into our savings until we had only enough to pay the rent for next month and hire a team of horses and a wagon to haul dragon wings up to the top of our hill and fly it. Even though dragon wings did have wheels, we needed to carry it in a wagon because its wheels would have sunk into the ruts in the road and its wings, brushing the ground, might have gotten torn or even broken. If that test flight worked, we'd borrow money somehow and do it a second time, but for an audience of paying spectators. And with the money from that, we'd pay our rent for the next month and hire another team of horses and fly at some county fair near here, and so on. To be honest, it did not sound like much of a plan to me. Father was more of a mechanical artist than a businessman. He wanted so badly to fly that it never occurred to him that people might not pay to see him fly. Sometimes people want a thing so much that they lose their common sense. But if Father had been practical, he probably would not have been trying to fly in the first place. I shut out all those worries, like what would happen if we tested dragon wings and it did not fly, or how to drum up an audience if dragon wings did test out. It was around the end of that same August of 1909 that I began to get jumpy, like I was being watched sometimes from the trees, sometimes from the vacant mansion. At first, I told myself it was just nerves. After all, I was getting positively ancient, for I was now 15, or 14 by demon reckoning. It was not so much my age that bothered me. It was the fact that after 6 years here in the land of the Golden Mountain, I had even less chance of seeing Mother. I was proud of Father for wanting to be a dragon again, and even prouder of the fact that he was now so close to achieving his ambition to fly. I was just sorry that we had not been able to combine his more lofty goals with the more ordinary dream of seeing Mother. Of course, Father thought he could, but even so his scheme had an awful lot of ifs in it. But Mother was patient, so I had to be too. And the feeling that there was someone or something else around kept on growing inside me. Sometimes at night when I came back to the barn, I would find a chair where I was sure it had not been, or books misshelved. But with no real definite proof, I held my peace. On the first Sunday in September, we had the Whitlaws down to help us christen dragon wings. The night before, Father and I spent all our time painting scales on the wings, and as an extra touch, Father had painted eyes on two squares of canvas and added them to the front rudders. They hung limp now, but during the flight, they would flap like flags. After they had admired our paint job, Miss Whitlaw produced a small bottle of wine.
"For the christening," she said, "whatever it is to be named."
"Dragon Wings," Father said.
"That's a funny name," Robin said.
"Ah, well, it's a lucky name,"
Father shrugged. His dream was still something very special and very private and not to be shared even with the Whitlaws. Robin wrapped both her hands around the neck of the bottle and tapped it lightly on the frame. None of us was very sure about how strong the frame really was. The bottle broke, and Robin ignored the wine stains on her dress to declare in a very solemn voice,
"I christen you Dragon Wings."
But it was mid-September before we could even think of flying Dragon Wings. The rains did not clear until that second week of September, near the time when we had to pay our rent. The deliveries were light on the sixth day of the week, and after I finished my chores at the store, I was let off early. But when I got home and opened the side door to the barn, I found Black Dog there, rummaging through our bedding. He sat down on a stool when he saw me.
"How do you do, Moonshadow?
What are you doing here?"
"Can't one cousin visit another cousin? It's a lonely country. Maybe I missed the sight of your monkey's face."
He bent his elbow and scratched himself like a monkey for a moment. He had always tried to make jokes like that, but they were never very funny. I saw that time had not been very kind to him. "Do you want some tea before you go?" I asked. Black Dog smiled coldly.
"You have all my father's charm and tact, do you know that?"
"What do you want?" He waved a hand at an old, overstuffed chair we had found in the mansion and brought into the barn.
"Come, sit and talk with a lonely man."
His voice grew hard when I remained standing.
"I said sit."
"I'll stand if you don't mind." Black Dog shrugged. He leaned forward and clasped his hands together, resting his elbows on his knees.
"We never did get to finish that talk we began a long time ago."
"About what?"
"About those two lovers, to whose memory I have consecrated myself."
"You mean the demon dung?" Black Dog laughed and regarded me in a cold, shrewd way.
"I want you to tell me about the thing you find yourself married to. Your life, that is. I want you to tell me why you don't think your life is ugly."
He waved a hand around.
"You live by yourself with your father, whom you hardly see. You live in a place unfit even for animals. It is cold in the winter and an oven in the summer. Your clothes are patched. You are undernourished because all your money goes into this demon contraption that you are not even sure will work. And you don't think your life is ugly."
"What do clothes or food or a house mean?" I shrugged. Suddenly I realized something. "You're jealous, aren't you? You're jealous that we have something to believe in." Black Dog stopped scratching his leg and slipped his hand into his boot. He pulled out a knife.
"I'd like you to find the beauty in my cutting off your nose and ears."
He got up slowly. He was smiling to himself.
"Yes, I'd like you to try to tell people how beautiful you are with only a stub of a tongue."
I grabbed the nearest thing to hand. It was one of Father's books. I threw it at Black Dog, but he ducked. He came toward me slowly, the knife gleaming in his hand. I turned and darted out the door. Black Dog was right behind me. I could hear his boots pounding the ground. I ran through the tall flowers in the garden and made it into the orchard. I wanted to take a shortcut through the orchard to the road leading down to the town, but then my foot caught in a root. I fell forward into the weeds and old leaves. I got up on my hands and knees and caught Black Dog's boot in my ribs. I toppled over onto my back. He drove a knee hard into my stomach.
"Or maybe I'll take a testicle or two."
He let up on my stomach a bit so I could breathe. I suppose he wanted me to get enough air so I could beg, but I suddenly got sick of the whole cat-and-mouse game.
"Go on," I told him. "Get it over with, then."
"You won't be singing that tune the first time the knife breaks your precious skin."
When I did not say anything, Black Dog smiled. Well, you're a plucky lad, though you're a fool. I'll let you get off easily if you tell me where you keep your money. No. He jabbed his knee into my stomach and pressed the knife point against my throat. Come on. Come on. Tell me where the money is. You just said yourself that money wasn't important. Dragon Wings is. We heard a branch snap then. Black Dog did not look around. He kept the knife to my throat. I felt my throat muscles begin to tighten as if they were trying to crawl away from the point.
Don't take another step, Black Dog warned. I can cut your son's throat before you can jump me. Don't harm him, Father said.
I heard him walk around from behind us until he stood in front of Black Dog.
How important is that demon contraption to you? Black Dog asked. It's very important. More important than your son's life.
Don't tell him, Father, I said.
No, Father said. I'll get the money for you.
Father, don't! But I saw Father walk over to a nearby oak tree. An old battered birdhouse swung from one of its branches. Father reached up. Even he had to stand on tiptoe to get it. He took it down and pulled off the rooftop. It was only tacked on lightly with very small nails. He took the money out, a thin roll of demon dollar bills, and tossed the birdhouse down. He put the bills into his big handkerchief and tied up the corners into a bundle. Then he tossed it over to Black Dog. Black Dog snatched it up like a hungry dog after a bone. He stuffed it into his pockets.
I should slit your son's throat anyway, and you know I'd never rest till I got even with you. Yes, I respect you at least that much.
Black Dog got up and ran off into the trees. I started to get up to chase him, but I felt suddenly dizzy. I must have banged my head when I fell, and my chest where he had kicked me felt suddenly tight. I fell forward.
Moonshadow, Father said. He bent over me.
Go after him, I said. That bastard! That son of a bitch!
He's still our cousin, despite what Uncle did, Father said sternly.
He helped me back into the stable and brewed some tea. Father poured a cup for me from the teapot and gave it to me. I drank it. Outside, I could hear the rain. I'm sorry you had to tell him. Father patted my arm and managed to smile.
It doesn't matter. I'm going down to report this to the sheriff now.
Do you think it might do any good?
It might, Father grinned and shrugged. And it might not.
It was getting near sunset now. I could see the red light within the barn. Our rent money had been in that roll, as well as the money we had planned to use for renting a wagon and a team of horses. What we were going to do for money, I didn't know. Well, the sheriff never did catch Black Dog. And the next day, when the landlord came around for his rent, he got mad at Father when Father asked him for an extension. He gave us 3 days to come up with the money, or he'd claim everything inside the place. But we didn't know anybody in the town we could borrow money from. They all thought of Father as the crazy Chinaman. We knew beforehand that Miss Whitlaw did not have any money she could lend out, for Robin's college money was sacred and untouchable, even if we were inclined to ask. And Father was too proud to go back to the company.
We had to go, but how? Dragon Wings was too big to be carried on our backs, and we had no money to hire a wagon.
We tried all the next day, but no one would rent us one on credit, not to the crazy Chinaman. Even my employer in the store refused, saying it was too much money. It looked like we were stuck. We would be able to take away only what we could carry. We were going to lose our Dragon Wings. Father did not say anything when I put on my boots and hat and went down to the town through the rain to use the store's electric talker, or telephone, as the demons called it. I wound the crank with a whirring sound, and when the operator came on, I gave her the number of the house where the Whitlaws worked.
"Why, hello, Moonshadow," Miss Whitlaw said. "How are you?"
"Fine. I'm afraid you won't be able to come down tomorrow. We're moving."
"Oh, found a better place?"
"Yes. That's it."
"Well, let us give you a hand. No, no, I couldn't think of it. Nonsense. There's always work to be done. Expect us there right after church. No, please. You mustn't come, I said desperately. There was a pause at the other end of the line. Is there something wrong? She finally asked. No, no, everything's just fine. Well, then why can't we come over? She demanded. We'll just be busy. So busy you don't need help? Miss Whitlaw asked suspiciously. Yes, that's it, I said, and hung up before she could ask me anything else. The rain had stopped by the time I got back. I could not make out where Father was in the barn when I first got back. Then I made out a shadowy figure sitting near Dragon Wings. Father? He stirred in his corner. I heard a groping at the stove, and then he struck a match, and the light flared about his face as he bent over the kerosene lamp, intent on lighting it. He shook the match out and then trimmed the flame. Then, and only then, did he look up. He fumbled painfully for the right words.
It's finished, he finally said.
We still have a day to raise the money, I said grimly.
You will not go to Uncle, Father said.
He ran his hand lightly along the lower wing. He stood up suddenly and got his padded jacket from the nail on the wall. He put it on silently and gestured to me to accompany him. Outside, the night was a cool, crisp autumn evening. The rain had just washed everything, seemed to sharpen the plants' smells. The colors seemed brighter, and the beaded raindrops gleamed like jewels on the petals of the flowers and the leaves of the trees. It was clear for the moment, but I could see the fog beginning to move over San Francisco.
I could not see how people could stand to live in the flatlands when they could live in the hills. There is something about the view from the hill that is exciting, a kind of godlike perspective in which men become only tiny creatures walking about their toy houses on a patch of land which seems to float on a vast ocean under an even bigger sky. Father started to trudge up the hill. I had to run to catch up with him. The road was muddy, and our boots made wet, sucking noises. My jacket was not really thick enough to hold out the wind, and I pulled the collar tighter about my neck. It was a cold, sharp wind, but with a salt sea smell. Father glanced at me, but he still said nothing. The setting sun behind us cast long shadows, which raced up and up ahead of us along the road. And then, at the very top of the hill, we turned off, walking to the very edge of it and looking down on the barn below us. Father crossed his arms, slipping his hands into his armpits to keep them warm.
So, this is the way it ends, he said finally. We came so close, and yet we failed.
The fog had completely covered San Francisco now, and was rolling over the bay toward Oakland. It was as if the world below us were slowly fading away, like the dream it was. And only we existed now on a tiny island of reality here on this hilltop. Maybe this is the final test in this life, I suggested hopefully.
Father thought for a bit and laughed. Yes, maybe it is.
We can build another Dragon Wings.
You have your designs now, and we know all of the tricks of actually building an aeroplane.
Father grunted, and he smiled in his old way. Then he tilted back his head and began to sing. There is a little beauty in the opening of a flower. There is a little glory, though it only lasts an hour. There is a little sorrow in the final farewell kiss. There's only a little pain, though you'll never again see your miss. I have a little dream for the flying of a plane. I have a little scheme I'll follow yet again. There is a little heaven just around the hill. I haven't seen it for a long time, but I know it's waiting still. Then he clapped his hand on my shoulder.
How about a cup of tea to warm our old bones? He asked.
Poor black dog. There was some beauty to life after all.
even if it was only the beauty of hope.